originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is, of course, the show trainers listen to, and you are listening on Sirius 219, XM Channel 206, and, of course, streaming us worldwide on your computer or mobile device at horseracingradio.net. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, along with our producer, Lee Della Pina, who is in our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios. And this is going to be a bit of a different show for you here this afternoon, because you're not going to hear from a single trainer on tonight's edition of Trainer Talk, which sounds pretty bizarre, but you are going to hear from a few people who have the privilege of being around the young horses in our sport before they even begin their careers and get into the barn of a trainer. A couple of weeks ago, we had the privilege of bringing you coverage of the Fasig Tipton Saratoga sale. And I was able to sit down with some of the major players involved with that sale, including John Sakura, who is the president of Hillendale Farms in Lexington, Kentucky. Hillendale now stands some of the top stallions in the sport, and they've sold many of the top horses that we watched on the racetrack over the years and that we've talked to trainers about on this very same program. Craig Banderoff and his son Conrad now work together at Denali Stud. Craig and Holly Banderoff have been running Denali Stud for many years, and they have had a tremendous amount of success selling horses. So I had the privilege of talking with each of those folks prior to the sale, and you're going to hear those interviews. John Sakura coming up here in the first half of the show. Craig Banderoff and his young son Conrad, who is now working with him, sat down together for an interview. That interview coming up in the second half of Trainer Talk here tonight. So without further ado, John Sakura from Hillendale Farm. So if you look into the results at most of the major sales, you're going to see John Sakura and Hillendale Farms, because they have consigned so many big-time horses over the years, and they have bought so many big-time horses, and their stallions at the farm have produced so many big-time horses. And John Sakura, nice enough to spend a little time with me here today on the Horse Racing Radio Network. John, what's the key, my friend?
The key is staying alive. You know, you have in this business, no matter what facet you participate in, that of a breeder, that of someone that buys racehorses, trains racehorses, you try to associate yourself with, you know, the best horses and the best people. And, you know, everybody gets a turn. There's times when, you know, you'll follow your routine, your instincts will be sharp, you'll feel all the same thoughts, and, you know, things don't work out, and, you know, you have the same decision-making process, you know, the next time, and it works out, and just stay in the middle. You know, you can, the decisions sometimes work, sometimes they don't. And you just, horses are unique, and that's why you're allowed to bet on them. And, you know, that's why we have a public auction process in the sales ring, where it's, you know, it's speculative, and sometimes they bring more, sometimes they bring less than expected. And it's part of the process, part of the excitement. And, you know, there's always risk involved. And that's one of the attractions to the business for me.
Is it different when you're consigning horses and looking for horses to sell as opposed to when you're here as a buyer looking for horses to purchase?
You know, I guess in most cases I'm doing both at the same sale. So there really isn't really a dichotomy, because you're always looking to replenish and improve your broodmare band. So, you know, the majority of horses I buy would be broodmares for our broodmare band. And I would at that same sale be selling horses too. And fortunate to have, you know, one of the best guys in the world in you know, Donato Lanny, where he can do a lot of the legwork for me and look at the horses, and I'll give him hip numbers. And by the time I get to the sale, I've gone through the catalog 100 times, and I know what appeals to me for various reasons. And, you know, I try to be sort of self-limiting you know, you can always jump on a horse at the last second, or who's that? I didn't notice that mare, but I pretty much know beforehand what I want to do. And sometimes you have to, you know, leave from the barn, bid on the mare, come back to the barn. But it's not that unmanageable when you've, you know, we've been here 30 plus years. So you get to know that things don't happen, you know, and something new starts. Usually there's an overlap in you're on to the same subject before you've concluded the first one. Just like the sales, you know, you're weeding mares and you're selling horses and you're prepping for November and you're entering the Breeders' Cup at all. It seems like August 1st, everything has to be done the 1st of August. So we're, you know, you multitask a lot.
So tell me about picking out the right stallion, because your stallion roster at Hill and Dale is very, very strong and they produced a lot of really nice horses. How do you know when you're looking for a stallion that you're looking at the right horse?
I guess I will repeat what I said a minute ago, that, you know, I bought horses that I felt strongly about, and all the parameters that are important to me were there, and you get all excited, and the first one finishes fifth, the next one finishes eighth, and you soon realize that he's an inferior sire. So, you know, we've been very fortunate that we've had, you know, a run of extraordinary horses. We also had some that haven't made it, you know, and we had, you know, Candy Ride, who we made and launched, and, you know, it's I guess bittersweet, where, you know, the horse was moved with a, you know, a change in a family structure. Then Medaglidoro, you know, we had him first year, and, you know, we bred the, you know, Rich Alexandra, and you know, then gentleman started his own farm, and you know, he's now at Darley. So, you know, those things, you know, you're proud at the same time. There's, you know, there's losses along the way, and then, you know, you have to just regroup and battle. And it took, you know, a few years and to sort of improve our lineup. And, you know, fortunate to, you know, Curlin, he's arguably one of the best sires in America, one of the elite sires in the world, and a prolific producer. We had nothing to do with his prior success, but he bred great mares at the farm past 2 years, and we think he's going to be, you know, annually, you know, a talked about horse at the highest level. And McLean's Music had a classic winner's first crop, very satisfying, because that's a horse that, you know, I was, like Candy Ride, completely attracted to his ability. I thought he was a supernatural talent, and, you know, we've had good support from breeders, and Stone Street have supported us, and you know, then our Atreides as yearlings this year, we're excited about them. Didn't breed as many mares as we would have hoped. He's a bit of a story. I think the story is all valid, and it's a great story, but, you know, there's a lot of choice. So I'm looking forward to those two-year-olds running. McLean's just, we just discussed, Violence is off to a fantastic start. I was in Del Mar with my son the other day, and, you know, he went back to back, and we flew home the next day, and then I got off the plane, and he'd won the last race as well. So he was 3 for 3. They run dirt and turf and short and long and two turns and colts and fillies. So, you know, those kind of things really are great positives. You know, he has to continue, but let's hope he's the heir apparent to his great sire, Medaglidoro. So very, you know, good thing about this business, I don't play golf, but a guy told me once about golf, two things. Once he said, if he wasn't married, he wouldn't even play, meaning that's his way he could get out of the house for 6 hours. And then secondly, you can play your entire life. And, you know, the great thing about this game is you can play your entire life, and you look at a global phenomenon of Judman Farm. I mean, you've got a man in his 80s who had Arrogate and Frankel in the last, you know, late stages of his life, and champions from 40 years ago. So it's a great game. It's one where you've never arrived. You always have to get better. You could never be satisfied with where you are, or where you've been. You have to continually strive on where you're going. And I don't mean you're dissatisfied or you're never happy. That's not the case. But you can never. It's much like any sports team. As soon as you think your team is good enough, you don't stockpile draft choices, you don't make good trades. Next thing you know, the team that was last wins whatever the championship is, the NBA, the Super Bowl, whatever, and you wonder what happened to your team. So you know, I always try to really critically look at what we have, where we are, what we're doing, and never get boastful, and deep inside realize that, you know, we need to get better. And that's I think that's probably a common thing in most operations that remain valid in the marketplace. Not everybody's around for 10, 20, 30 years and still playing at the top. And if you want to be one of those, you have to really, really scrutinize what you're doing and, you know, detect market trends. Things change. The staying business has changed a lot. There's a lot of incentives. There are a lot of different things that never existed. So if you didn't see it coming, or you didn't accept it coming, or you're resistant to any change, then unless you have a lot of money, you were probably in and now out of the business. So, every part of life changes. So this business will be the same. I mean, think of telephones and all. There's so many things that are irrelevant today that, telephone answering machine. If you made millions of them and you said they'll be here forever, you'd be out of business. And if you thought a young horse, you could just say he stands for 5,000 and wait for the phone to ring and think you're going to breed 100 mares, not going to happen. You have to incentivize people and you have to do deals and, all kinds of ways. So a guy like Wayne Hughes, while haven't always been in agreeance with everything that he's done, he's made everybody better. He's let the breeder recognize that you have say, you have power. And, that message then to the stallion owners is you better provide us value. We need to have some equity. We're doing a lot of work and you need to take care of us. So there's no guarantee season sold anymore. You don't pay in September. You pay when your foal is born. There's breeding rights. There's all kinds of things. So, initially there's always stakeholders are always resistant to change because it affects their bottom line and how they do business. And then the smart ones adapt and change and get better and find a new way to compete with the new reality, or, they complain as retirees. So I want to be one of the guys that stays in business, and by no means do we think we have it figured out, but we try to ask questions, try to watch trends, and try to stay on top of things. And bottom line, you have to have a passion for the horse. And if I buy a stallion, it's a horse I believe in, then I think it's going to be an important sire that I send mares to and I'm committed to. And if you're fortunate enough to have one, two, three, or five of them that become significant sires, then naturally you start to get some following and your voice has some credibility with people that you do business with. And the opposite's true. If you're 0 for 5, then it's probably a customer you used to have that now trades somewhere else. So you can't control a lot of things, but you try to deal with good people and good horses.
And you talk about that desire to keep getting better. People may not realize that you played hockey at a very high level as you were growing up. Does that desire to get better and that competitive nature come from playing sports?
I mean, I think everyone's experience in their life leads you to your business career, and hockey is a great sport. And, I played and played at a pretty high level, but I recognized that there's an elite level to which I wish I could have played, but I wasn't within my physical or my skill set to be able to do that. But, I think when you recognize talent and you're around athletics, you have an appreciation for someone that's effortless and talented. And, I played with lots of guys that played in the NHL, and that recognition of somebody different, pretty similar to the horse, because those guys recovered faster than everybody else. They could take a longer shift, and they intuitively made decisions that if you watch in slow motion, you'd make the same decision. But in the quickness of the game, you wouldn't have made that same play. So, it's a lot like a horse there. The good horses can take hard training. They train fast. They bounce back. They run the right back. They run even better. The harder you step on them, the more you ask them to do, the more you respond. But if you had that same approach to an average horse, every time they run, they get slower, they get lighter. I think the appreciation of athletic talent, probably it's something you can, is transferable to a horse. You look at a sleek, elite, race mare, race horse in the flesh, they're different. Their attitude's different. The way they move it's different. Their physicality is different. So, you know, if you played lacrosse, you'd relate to a lacrosse player. Me, I played hockey, so I relate to a hockey player. And the appreciation for someone who could do something I couldn't is, you know, remains with you. And to see a horse that can do things that other horses don't do, that's the same appreciation. I was, you know, just before it came, I was riding on the farm with my son. We have a mare on the farm called Midnight Lucky, and she just galloped across the field, and her feet never touched the ground. And there's a mare that's had, you know, two foals. She's retired, but she was brilliant, and she just looked, you know, snow white standing in the middle of the field. Just had a presence and agility and athleticism that was different. And she's in a field of serious group, but, you know, she was the star of the show. So, you know, hopefully you notice those things. And, you know, lots of times you don't notice them until after they've won those races. And I guess you transfer some of those qualities onto them. But sometimes they're always different. And, you know, from the first time you see them, or those, you know, stallion comes to the farm, they're big and athletic and masculine and just own the place. Those are neat things to watch. So, you know, again, those are high-quality horses, and that's what you like to be around.
Talking with John Sakura of Hillendale Farm here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. John, Bill Mott once told me that there was a time when he couldn't get stalls at Centennial Park because his horses weren't good enough. And then all of a sudden he walks down his shed row one day and he sees champion after champion after champion. Things weren't always like this for John Sakura and Hillendale. You have achieved so much in the game right now, but at some point it wasn't like that. Take me back to the beginning of Hillendale and John Sakura's career.
Too long of a story, but you know, you have a passion for the horse. You have, in my case, at a young age, I was exposed to some, you know, Canadian breeders were amongst the best in North America, and I got to see Winfield's farm pedigrees developed. I got to see Samson pedigrees develop, and Jean-Louis Levesque with Lavoie Jus and all of her daughters. So I started to really study that, and I was just obsessed with watching female families, watching them develop, having my own impression of what I thought could be prolific or multi-generational, and then to watch sometimes it happened, sometimes it didn't, you know, trial and error. And then at a young age, I was 15, I took over the consigning business of Hillendale in Ontario. We didn't have a Kentucky operation. I was selling horses and, you know, the front man. So that was a real turn on for me. The market was obviously different. You didn't sell horses like you did in Kentucky. And then my dad bought a small place in Kentucky. And in the meantime, I was playing hockey in Europe and realized that wasn't going to be for me anymore. And moved to Kentucky and a hockey bag and I rode in the horse van and slept in a bale of straw and arrived, and you know, that was 35 years ago. So there's a lot along the journey, and you know, the most tragic thing ever happened in my life was losing my father, and it happened at a relatively young age, and that gave me the courage to move forward, at least to, you know, swing as hard as I can to really try. And I'd say for the, you know, the 10 years prior, I was, you know, doing a lot of work and in the business, but probably didn't dream as big as I dreamt after. And that gave me the courage to move forward without worrying about a consequence. And bought Northridge Farm, and, you know, I still think about that now. It's like, I've ever had the recurring dream. I've had this where you didn't graduate from high school, wake up in a panic. I didn't finish high school. So that's when it's sometimes like, I can't believe I bought that farm. So it was, and we had to, we gave them the farm we had, and as a down payment for that one. And it was about 8 years of holding your breath. And, you know, but I don't think, you know, there was never a worry. It was just, you know, work hard and try to explore opportunities. And, you know, we've had some great people, great things happen with, you know, Better Than Honor and the development of the Dejean family and some things that have, you know, bought and sold a lot of very exquisite mares. And, you know, all about the horse, and then relationships too. You know, we try to always have a pretty simple credo that if I tell you have a deal, then it's done, or if I shake your hand, it's done. And you know, over time, you know, you don't get to do business with everybody, and this business is no different than a lot of others were. Just because somebody says something, and I learned this. I guess I was naive. And, you know, when someone tells you they'll do something, it doesn't mean they'll do it. They just want you to be committed in case they decide to fall through, you know? And so, you know, I get a few hurtful experiences and, you know, try easier said than done because I'm a competitive guy, but, you know, try not to be, you know, too hurt by it, just to learn from it and toughen your skin. And, you know, the best way to get ready for a team that beat you or after you get beat is get ready for the next time you play them. So try to, you know, be prepared. And hard work overcomes everything. So, you know, I tell my kids, try to have a, you know, you're like me where you have a limited ability, have an unlimited work ethic. And in the end, that beats everything. The only thing it doesn't beat is a supernatural talent with an unlimited work ethic. But they're so rare that, you know, they're off the charts. Don't even consider them because there's no way to, you know, you look at a guy like a Bob Baffert or, you know, there's the odd genius. You just work with him and, you know, if you can be a confident friend, great, but just stay out of their way because pick an easier spot if somehow you think you're going to, you know, you're going to get in front of them. It's great to watch them.
Was there a moment when you said to yourself, you know what, I can do this and I can be really good at this profession?
Well, I think I always had confidence that at least I've always known what I think is good. And the leap of faith is to then go to the bank and borrow money and bet on yourself. And well, it's nerve-wracking, but it's also satisfying, too, when it works out. And, you know, I think we have 4 or 5 world records on horses that we've sold. And, you know, more than one of those we own, either in partnership or outright. So, you know, once it's like once it happens once or twice, and then you start to get more confidence in what you're doing, and then you do more of it, and you know the stakes get higher. And but it's a real appeal that you know there's a risk and a reward, and if it works out good, it's significant. If it works out bad, it hurts, and I prefer to do it that way than. And you know, stealing first. I want to try to get the grand slam. Not every time, but you know, when you feel it. And that's been sort of the approach. You grow in confidence over time and understanding of marketplace, and hopefully understanding what people want and how they're going to react to certain things. That you grow in confidence with that, and then you know you try to put yourself in a position that you have what those people want to buy.
You're a wonderful father and a tremendous family man, and you mentioned your children a few times here as we've been talking. Do you ever see your children following in your footsteps and maybe taking over someday?
Well, that's up to them. I mean, they're going to be exposed. I have my eldest son here with me, Saratoga, for the weekend. He was at Del Mar before this, and I told a friend, I asked if I was coming, if I was bringing my son. I said, I am. And he brought his hockey equipment so he can skate doing that. And he's going to go to the races. He's going to watch Keen Ice. And if Del Mar and Saratoga don't hook you, then you need to go do something else. So it's all there for them. And if they have the passion, great. But I don't ever want to have a bitter kid that feels he has to follow in his father's footsteps. He needs to do whatever he does. And I told him the only one rule I have is that whatever you do, you have to have a passion for it, and you have to do your best. And I wouldn't tell him what that endeavor is. Just you know, you got a name on your back, and it's my name, and it was handed down from a father and another father, and came from nobody and nothing, from you know, a family that escaped the communist country and couldn't speak the language of English. So that's where you started, and you got a good head start.
When you think back on everything that you've accomplished in the game, what are you most proud of?
You know, I think we're hopefully it's yet to be accomplished. I mean, we're now bred a Belmont and a Preakness winner. So if I was able to, I don't really think of writing things down. You can only live your life on, you know, a certain achievement. But if we could breed a Derby winner and then have bred three individual horses to win all three legs of Triple Crown, that would be pretty amazing. We've owned an interest in Eclipse Champions. You know, we've owned a Broodmare of the Year. That's probably, as a breeder, that's the highest honor, and I'd like to do that again and again and again if that's possible. But again, we don't do what we do for a specific award or recognition. If you do things at the highest level and you work hard and you know, do the right thing, you know, all those things come. And so, you know, try to be a good horseman, take care of the horse, you know, develop female families. You know, we've been involved in Serena's Cat and Serena's Song, which has been prolific. Dejin and Serenading and hand painted that family, prolific. And then I retained the Stormcat daughter, Teeming. She's been fantastic producers. We have all of her daughters, so we've been, you know, lucky enough to be in some of those families now. Take Charge Brandy, and if that could be another legacy family, that would be great. But you know, yeah, I just want to keep trying to be relevant and trying to, you know, do good things and, you know, be associated with good people and good horses. And you know, I guess my hope for the game is that it will, you know, kind of rectify itself. I think we've been, for maybe it's 15 years, maybe it's a few more, a few less, we've all talked about the same dilemmas and concerns, and nothing's really happened to make things better. And then you go to, you know, a day like this at Saratoga, and the purses are great, and people are filing in at 11 o'clock to have picnics and go to the races. It shows you that it's a great experience, and, you know, the gambling and the dynamics of ADWs, and there's a lot of changes. So hopefully we'll stay relevant. And I guess if I had a wish aside from myself, it would be that horse racing could be relevant in the culture, particularly to young people, like everything else is. And I think we've done, I can't even use the word poor, because it's an infinitesimal effort to expose ourselves to kids. And whether we like it or not, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, everybody that owns a horse will be dead. And unless there's a new generation to own a horse, it really won't matter how many you breed, because the guy that has the biggest risk in the game is the guy that buys them and goes to races. So, you know, we want to attract those people. We want to show that we're a sport that has integrity. We're a sport that's can include family, can spend the day out there, and then there's gambling. There's so many facets to it, and not enough people know about it. And then, unfortunately, what they know, a lot of the stereotypes are negative. Many of them are reported from within, I think, for self-serving means. And I think that's unfair, that you don't respect the game above your own way that you want it to be played. Have your own opinions, but you never, you know, you should never discredit the game. I know you have a baseball background, and I know nothing about baseball. I really don't have much interest. But one thing I've always found really admirable is the way they keep stats. All these things go back 50 years, 60 mm-hmm. years ago, and there's an integrity of the game that trumps all. And you got to respect your game. And, you know, in hockey, you know, they name trophies after guys that have been dead for 30, 40, and 50 years. And, you know, they hoist the Lady Bing and the Clancy and all, you know, there's a real respect for the game. There's statistics and everything, and they're hard kept. And you know, it's really an honor, that record book. And, we you know, we need to have the same in this game. It seems unreasonable that we can't take a Saratoga, Del Mar, Keeneland experience and make that an experience in four or five places. Everybody I've brought to Keeneland, if not one of them would have left, I could have sold a horse to. You know, they couldn't. Yeah. They wouldn't leave without a horse. And that's why I think the Breeders' Cup is such a great event in Keeneland, that we're selling a lifestyle. you know, we're showing farms where it all starts. There's that, you know, appreciation for the horse. There's it makes the sales better. Everybody's there, and you know, just something simple like that, where you know, when you feel suspense in the air in any event, you're at the Breeders' Cup. It's palpable. American Pharoah in the paddock. There's a stillness. There's something happening there. That doesn't. Those sights, smells, sounds, emotions, do not transmit over a telephone or even over a television screen. Now, it's nice to be on all platforms, but people and how you drive people to the track. What is there? You know, prizes, giveaways, is the experience so good that they'd want to be there versus someone else? We're competing for other people's time and dollars, and you know, we have to do it in a new way and in a better way, and I think in a diverse way. Where how many times have you read stories about horse owners? Well, I went to UK and I moved out of town. And I've always said to myself, when I can afford it, I get back in. So those young experiences are deeply embedded in people. What you're around as a kid, you know, eventually go back to. So we need to expose people to racing, and not even at the highest levels, because you know, you'd mentioned Bill Mott. Where did he start? And you know, I remember going to Fort Erie, and like not everybody has to start at Keeneland. So we just have to be kind of pervasive, where everybody is around it, knows about it, and the can it be done? Well, what about the MMA? If someone would have told you we're going to get in a ring in a cage, and
yeah,
before you finish, you'd already walk away from him. Now, Conor McGregor's going to fight in a how many X hundred million dollar fight, and it'll be the biggest event this year. Who knows the outcome, but everybody's going to watch. So we've got the best horse in the world that's here. We've got a Triple Crown winner. We've got Songbird. We have so many great stories, and the people behind the game, that what they went through and where they started and where they finished, and there's I think it's the greatest game there is.
Well, it's hard to sum it up any better than that. John Sakura from Hillendale Farm with me here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. When we come back, you're going to hear from Craig Bandroff and his son Conrad, who took the time to sit down together for a very special interview. That's next on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. The inaugural Fasig Tipton Turf Showcase takes place Sunday, September 10th in Lexington, Kentucky. An exciting addition to the Fasig Tipton sales calendar, the Turf Showcase is the only yearling sale in North America exclusively for horses with turf appeal. Did you know that nearly 7,000 races were run on turf in North America in 2016? And more than 40% of graded stakes this year will be turf races. The demand is growing, so don't miss your chance to buy a yearling with true turf appeal. Sunday, September 10th in Lexington, Kentucky. Visit FasigTipton.com.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at BloomRacing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Ross Amaya, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN, presented by Fasig Tipton.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, in our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studio, and happy to have you back with us here on the program for a very special edition of Trainer Talk. You had a chance to hear from John Sakura, the president of Hillendale Farm, with some very interesting things to say in the first half of the show. Coming up now, We're going to hear from Craig Bandroff and his son Conrad, who has recently started working with him at his Denali stud. They'll talk about their relationship, and they'll talk about some of the highlights in the career of Denali stud and some of the things that they're looking to do moving forward. But do want to remind you, if you missed any portion of this show, head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast of this show and all of our programs. They're there for you, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. And here's my interview with Craig Bandroff and his son, Conrad. Craig and Holly Bandroff have had a tremendous amount of success selling horses over the years through their Denali stud, and now they have the privilege, I guess, or maybe even the pleasure of being joined by their eldest son, Conrad, who is 25 years old. He joined the Denali team in June, and for Conrad, it's been quite a journey, and now they get to work together and go down the rest of this journey together. Pretty special, and looking forward to this visit here with both Craig and with his son, Conrad. Conrad, let's start with you, my friend. You grew up around horses, obviously being with your dad and being around horses for the whole time and being in the family. You kind of had a bit of an entrepreneurial spirit from a very young age, if I recall. I hear you make a mean lemonade. Is that true?
Yeah, I make some good lemonade, and I can shine shoes pretty well. So, Roy and Gretchen Jackson, who, we've known for a long time, they fondly tell a story of I used to set up a lemonade stand on the corner of Nelson. So, I was always entrepreneurial, and I think I always enjoyed business. And, you know, I think that kind of shone through. And as an undergrad, I studied economics, and I minored in business. And, this courtyard was kind of where I applied my trade a little bit growing up.
You don't want to talk about your parking cars experience?
Oh, yeah, that's a whole other story. So,
was that here in Saratoga?
It was. I did a three-year tenure on the Muck crew, and I was young. And when all the guys would go back to the bunkhouse, which no longer stands, to nap and sleep off the hangovers, I would be relegated to the parking lot to keep cars from the track there. And I ran a pretty good little business of collecting tips, which we were not supposed to collect, and then eventually sneaking in a few cars from the track and charging 15 or 20 bucks. And got caught one day, and I think if they could have fired me, they would have.
Craig, when he's doing that and he's going through all those different jobs and doing those types of things, did you ever imagine that he'd be sitting here next to you now and we'd be talking about Conrad being your right-hand man, so to speak?
Yeah, no, not really, Mike. I mean, I think I'm like a lot of fathers. You know, you really don't want your son to come into your business because you know how tough your business is. You know, I know a lot of doctors tell their kids don't become doctors or lawyers. And so it wasn't something, you know, we ever encouraged. But I think, you know, besides his entrepreneurial spirit, you know, Conrad showed at a very young age a great work ethic. You know, like when he was on the Muck crew here, I mean, he got out of bed. Hell, he was only 12 or 13. He was only on there because of our relationship. And, you know, and then once he developed, I said to him, look, if you think you want to do this, then you need to go to the racetrack. And, like, that's where it all starts. I think it's a really important foundation. And, you know, lo and behold, he's getting up at 4:30 in the morning and never missing a day. Then when I saw that he developed a passion for horses, you know, that's kind of when we finally became okay with it. And, you know, I think you have to have that because, as you know, it's a tough business. I mean, you know, they'll give you the highest highs, but there's plenty of days they'll break your heart. So it's not something we planned. It's not something we encouraged, but as it began to develop, you know, I certainly became okay with it.
What's it like for a father when your son comes to you and says, Dad, I really want to be like you. I want to follow in your footsteps.
Yeah, well, it's a wonderful thing, right? I mean, my father, God bless him, you know, sold insurance, and I knew I was never going to do that. So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of parts of life that are special, and that's probably about as special a thing as it can happen when, you know, one of your children wants to emulate you.
Conrad, why'd you want to do it so much?
You know, I think my dad mentioned it. I fell in love with horses, and you know, I love being around them, and for me it's about the animal. But as I kind of went out and started gaining different experiences in the business, I always had a special place in my heart for the farm aspect and the sales aspect. And you know, I tell people all I've ever wanted was to come back and help the family in the running of Denali. And so, you know, I'm thrilled to be back on the team, and you know, can say with confidence that I'm living my dream. So it's been great.
And you've gotten a lot of real world experience being part of the Darley Flying Start program and traveling all over the world. You worked for Hall of Fame trainer Bill Mott and for John Ward, and even spent some time with Peter Bradley, if I'm not mistaken. What part of that experience is helping you now? What's the most important thing that you learned that's helping you as you segue into working with your dad?
Well, you know, my racetrack experience really laid a foundation and a level of horsemanship. And, you know, I got to learn a great deal from both John Ward and Bill Mott. Every morning I met John Ward at the Dairy Queen in Frankfurt and would ride with him and his head exercise rider to Churchill Downs. And so the mornings when I could stay awake were spent asking him questions and just trying to pick his brain with someone who had a lifetime of horsemanship and experience. And my summer spent here on the backside of Oklahoma with Bill Mott was one of the best experiences of my career. You know, that was the summer when Royal Delta, Ron the Greek, Flat Out, To Honor and Serve, you know, we had some really nice horses. And so to get to work with them was a privilege, and to get to work with a horseman and Hall of Famer with the likes of Bill Mott was incredible. And, you know, when I was with Pete, I kind of gained an appreciation for the other side of the fence. I've seen the consigner's perspective my whole life, but stepping over and seeing what it's like as a bloodstock agent and going around the sales and looking at all the horses, I learned a great deal from that, from both Pete and Eddie and Liz Crowe at the time. And then I had the good fortune of spending some time in Australia. I studied abroad there as an undergraduate and spent some time with Arrowfield. And so that gave me exposure to kind of the stallion industry and working for a commercial operation. You know, I mean, obviously we are a commercial operation, but we don't stand stallions. So seeing that arm in the marketing division, I think has helped me a lot, and not only kind of gave me the foundation to get me to where I am today, but just kind of gave me a well-rounded experience.
I had the privilege of working with my father for many years in our family business, and there were times it could get a little bit tense. I was the young buck. I thought I knew everything, and he had all the experience. How does this dynamic work between the two of you now, Craig?
Well, I don't think we're into it long enough yet, Mike. You know, Conrad graduated from the Godolphin Flying Start course in end of June. I mean, we hit the ground running because of September sales and Saratoga, and you know, I mean, I think something about Conrad's personality is, you know, he's very level-headed, you know, he's very rational, and he's willing to take it all in. So, and I think, to my credit, you know, I don't feel like, I mean, we've been very successful, you know, we do a lot of the things the right way, but you can always do better, you know, I mean. And he's been around the world. He's seen a lot of operations. And, you know, if he has an idea that, you know, that we think can help, then I'm certainly open to it. You know, there's so many things in this that are innate. You know, you can't really teach it. You have to learn it. And, you know, funny story about when he was with Bill Mott, I remember, you know, and Bill's a very good, you know, our families are close personal friends, and Conrad called one day and he said, you know, Dad, how do I learn what a good horse looks like? You know, I mean, I said, Conrad, why don't you start at one end of that shed row and look in those stalls and just keep on walking, right? You got Royal Delta, you got To Honor and Serve. And so, you know, I'm not saying we won't have those moments, but, and again, it's a little too early, but I think between his personality and really my desire, I need help, you know? I mean, I don't have the energy or the desire to do it like I did. So, you know, I think you might run into that more when there's a father that never wants to let go, you know? And I don't think that's me.
Yeah, yeah. Talking with Craig Bandroff, his son Conrad, here at Denali Stud with the Denali Consignment here at the Fasig Tipton Saratoga Sale. Craig, one thing that you have really mastered over the years is developing and maintaining those relationships with your clients. How important is it for you to instill in Conrad that aspect of the business?
Yeah, I think, you know, Conrad knows that. I mean, I think every business is a relationship business. I only know this business. And it's totally a relationship. You know, we can't cover the territory that a TaylorMade or some of these operations, you know, that are bigger can do. So, you know, our horses, you know, and thank goodness there's a lot of them and a lot of good ones, come from relationships with people. And people, you know, once you start a relationship, people keep it going as long as you do what they think you're supposed to do. So, and I think that's one of the beauty of the things he got to do with the Godolphin program. You know, I mean, they travel the world. They meet everybody. They have instant credibility because of the reputation of the program. So, and we've talked about that. You know, you've got to use those relationships to, you know, to develop new ones. You know, one of the biggest challenges all of us in this business have is, you know, we don't work for people in their 40s and 50s, right? So, you know, we hope these people are still going to be around a long time, but, you know, you've always got to cultivate the next group.
Yeah. Conrad, when you were traveling abroad, was it difficult to keep up with everything that your family had going on here with the consignments and selling horses?
Well, to be honest, no. I mean, I was going to follow closely no matter what, and I think a good example was we were selling, it was the September sale last year, and I was in Australia, which is a 12-hour time change. And for book one, I stayed up and I watched the sale. And I kind of hear my alarm go off, and I'm like, well, I guess I have to go to work now. And I had been awake. I watched the sale all night, and not that I was actually involved, but I was playing merely the role of a cheerleader. And you know, my dad and I are good about communicating. When I was on the program, you know, we would send emails to each other multiple times a day, and I would try and stay in the loop. But I didn't really have a role at that point. It was merely just he would be showing me things or taking teaching moments and, you know, little nuggets of wisdom that I would kind of observe and just try and store in the back of my mind.
Yeah, and it's worked very, very well. And your dad talks about working with Bill Mott and saying, okay, you want to know what a good horse is and what a good horse looks like, just walk down the shed row. You've been able to do that your whole life, though, because your dad's had a lot of really good horses come through the Denali program, too. Is there one that maybe stands out more than some of the others for you?
Oh, that's like asking who the favorite child is. But, you know,
Craig, who's the favorite child?
I think of a horse like Taproot for me is one that's a more recent, but one that sticks into my mind. He was actually, it's a neat story. That was the summer before I started the Godolphin Flying Start, and I spent that summer on the farm just helping with the prep, and he was one of the six horses that I was responsible for overseeing their prep and grooming every day. And he, you know, he was always a nice horse, but coming into the end of prep and coming up to the sale up here, he just really blossomed into a nice horse. And for me to be up here before leaving for 2 years and him selling for $1.2 million, it was really special. And then obviously I got to watch his career unfold still unfolding. And I came home for his Derby. I was in Ireland at the time, and I kind of said, look, if this horse runs a good race and I'm anywhere in the world, I'm gonna be kicking myself. And saying that, I came home for the Derby, and you know, he had a troubled trip, but still ran a very credible six. And you know, I think was probably a little unlucky not to maybe be fourth. And then I was on my final placement for the program. I was spending a month with Richard Hannon in England, And the Belmont came around, and about a week and a half before, he says, well, are you making the trip back? And I said, I don't know if I can. I'm pretty busy. And obviously, I know my time with the Hannons was a great experience, but I wish I could have been there for Belmont. But
yeah, Craig, how about for you? Names like Animal Kingdom and Serena's Song come to mind when you start thinking about Denali Stud. How about for you? Are there some moments or some of those times that are going to stand out maybe a little bit more than others?
Yeah, I mean, listen, we've been blessed. You know, we've had, you know, horses sell for lots of money and do really well, and we've raised good horses. And Serena's Song, I mean, if somebody asked me what am I most proud of, she'd be it. I mean, I remember when Mr. Lewis accepted her Hall of Fame award, and he credited me, you know, for contributing to her success as a broodmare. And I mean, look, it's mostly them. You know, we try to just pat things in the right direction, but you know, it's got to be Animal Kingdom. I mean, look, for whatever anybody's, it doesn't make any sense, but it's the race everybody wants to win. And then, you know, there's a lot of great races, but that's the one. And, you know, the kids had never gone to the Derby before. You know, they just never had. And Conrad's older sister was graduating college, and Conrad was great in graduating high school. And they put a lot of pressure on, said, you know, we want to go, we got to go. And it was really before Animal Kingdom, you know, won the race at Turfway and looked like he was going to be on the, you know, had a shot to really be competitive. And the fact that the whole family was there and you know, that, I mean, that's a moment I'll think about, you know, when they get ready to put me under, you know.
We could tell these stories all day long and look back on some of the great horses that have come through the Denali consignments. But when somebody comes by the Denali consignment today and they start looking at maybe some of the future stars, what are some of the things that you want to emphasize and make sure that they know when they stop by your consignment?
You know, I mean, I always say it's, look, you can just look across that wall and, you know, the Grade One stakes winners that have come out of this program. I mean, and it's the whole point of our advertising campaigns. I want, when people look at a yearling, you know, in our consignment, I want them to say, you know, this is a farm, this is a consigner that sells Saturday afternoon horses, you know, and if I buy a horse from them, I know it was raised the right way and it has a chance to be a Saturday afternoon horse. And I don't think everybody can say that. I mean, I think some people can, but you know, that's the thing I'm proudest of. I mean, we're here to, you know, to our job is to raise athletes, and we hope we're selling somebody an athlete. And you know, over the 25 years, there's a lot of names on that board, and to me, that's what it's all, you know, that's a big component of what it's about.
Conrad, you're shaking your head yes, like you agree wholeheartedly with what Dad has to say.
I mean, absolutely. You know, we pride ourselves on raising good horses and giving them the best opportunity to go on and achieve success on the racetrack. And at the end of the day, that's what it takes to be successful in this business is, you know, you want to sell good horses and you want people to do well off the horses that they buy from you. And when they do that, when you can sell a horse for $1.2 million that turns out to be a Belmont Stakes winner, you know, that gives them confidence that when they walk into your barn at your consignment, they know this is a place that raises horses the right way, and I know that I have a good chance of buying an athlete from them.
Now that you're working with your family, you're achieving, as you said earlier, kind of a lifelong dream of being part of the family business. What does the future hold? When you look into the future and you see Denali Stud 10, 15, 20 years from now, what do you see?
Well, you know, we've been fortunate. We've raised a Derby winner and now a Belmont winner, so let's hope that we can round out the trifecta and get a Preakness winner. And I think one race that we would love to have raised a horse to win would be the Kentucky Oaks, because we're not a stallion operation, and you know, a lot of our focus is on helping clients build and develop their broodmare portfolios. I think that's a race that would be really special for us to win. And you know, for it to be a horse that was bred on the farm or sold by the farm, you know, I think the dream would be for them to win and maybe hopefully one day come back to us. I think that would be really special. And, you know, races like the Breeders' Cup Classic. I mean, these are, you know, the goals of what you want to achieve. And, you know, there's no designs to start standing stallions. That's just not something that in the future I'd be interested in. I think we've developed a very good business. We're very good at what we do. And we can consider ourselves one of the best at what we do. And for me, as I look to the future of my career, that's what I want to focus on. I want to focus on things that, at the end of the day, I can say, well, I did that just as about as well as anybody else. And if I'm not confident that that's going to be the case, then I want to put my effort towards things that will be.
Well, pretty good vision. Conrad Banderoff, his dad, Craig Banderoff, Craig and Holly have developed Denali into one of the premier pillars of the sport when it comes to consigning horses. They do it as good, if not better, than anybody else. And Craig, can't thank you enough for spending a little time. Conrad, so happy to sit down with you. We're going to do this again in the future, no doubt, and all the best moving forward. Congratulations, guys. Really right. Happy
thank
to have you together.
Thank you very much, Mike. Those are big words and kind words, and they mean a lot. And we're grateful and appreciative.
Well, Craig and Conrad got off on the right foot at the Fasig Tipton Saratoga sale. They had a tremendous sale, and no doubt they'll have bigger things up the road as well. My thanks to all of our guests for joining me for those interviews on this somewhat unique and special edition of Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. That's John Sakura in the first half of the show, Craig Banderoff, his son Conrad, here in the second half. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. For our producer, Lee Delapina, and our Jimmy Johns of Lexington Studios, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton.